Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is simply the best way there is to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China, especially if you subscribe to our daily email newsletter, SubChina Access. Visit SubChina.com also to check out our wide range of reported pieces, op-eds, videos, and of course, podcasts. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and today's show is produced in collaboration with the Social Science Research Council, the SSRC. It's part of a series of three shows that Seneca and SSRC are co-producing, which will all highlight the groundbreaking work of young social scientists working on China. Today's guest certainly has been doing some amazing groundbreaking social science research. I am thrilled to be joined by Jennifer Pan. Jen is Assistant Professor of Communication at Stanford University, and like many of our listeners, I've been following her work for many, many years now. She first came to my attention in 2013 for a paper she co-authored with the well-known Harvard political scientist Gary King, who's sort of the king, as it were, of statistical studies of political science, and with Margaret Roberts, who listeners will know from her previous appearance not so very long ago here on Seneca. That paper, which many of us know as King Pan Roberts, or just KPR, was a pioneering study of how internet censorship in China actually works. Molly Roberts, of course, went on to write a book about censorship called Censored, which we've talked about, and which I encourage you to check out if you haven't already, both the book and the show. Jen, meanwhile, has also continued to work on issues related to the way that China's leadership shapes narratives and public opinion, doing some of the most interesting social science research on China that I have come across. So Jennifer Pan, welcome to Seneca.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's a high time we did. Jen, there's a kind of through line, a common thread in the many research projects that you've undertaken, especially in recent years. My sense is that, tell me if I'm wrong, but you're chiefly interested in the means by which the Chinese Communist Party exerts and maintains control, not just how it governs, but more specifically how it prevents instability and how it deals with perceived threats to its control. And either because you suspected the old narratives around things like censorship or propaganda or disinformation, if you suspected those were in need of complication, or just because you discovered that they were more complicated, your research tends to attack these problems through really good social science methodology. And I think it's particularly interesting how creative the research design is that you bring to this, and we'll talk about that a lot today. Do you think, is that a fair characterization of your particular research interests and your approach?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I'm very much interested in how the Chinese government, how the Communist Party exerts control over society, the ways in which it tries to do this, what outcomes it generates, when does it work, when does it not work, when does it generate unexpected consequences. So across all my work, even though I've worked on things as different as censorship and social welfare, I think that is a common theme.
Yeah, and we'll get into social welfare first of the different topics that we're going to be talking about. You've done work, like you said, on censorship, on the Great Firewall, and the so-called 50-cent party, the Umaodong, the social credit system. Much of it, like you said, focuses on technological means of control, but again, like social assistance, which is the first topic for us, these are not technological solutions, but they're still leveraged for information control. Two of the topics that we're going to talk about really are not technology, but one of them is. Let's start by looking at this book of yours, which is just terrific. It just came out in May of this year, I believe. Is that right?
That's right. With COVID, there was a little bit of a delay in actual printing of the book. So I think it was available digitally before it actually came out in print. But yeah.
Yeah. It's called Welfare for Autocrats, How Social Assistance in China Cares for Its Rulers. It's really great. I was only able to read it over the weekend, but it's fascinating. Listeners to our show will be familiar with the DBAO system, China's most basic, largest social assistance program. We've had one of the foremost authorities on the DBAO system, Gao Qin, on the show now twice to talk about its role in poverty alleviation. But today we're going to be talking about a very different aspect of DBAO. Jen, can you talk about the origin of this work, how you got onto this thesis? Because it doesn't sound like you started off looking to find out how this is used in social control.
That's right. When I first started this project, I was purely interested in social security and welfare in urban China. So picking up on the work of Professor Gao, Professor Dorothy Solinger. And I thought I'd be focusing on, you know, local capacity, financing, things like that. But when I got on the ground and started visiting urban neighborhoods and talking to residents' committees, administering the DBAO program, DBAO recipients, people who've been denied DBAO, this project evolved into something else. And so I would say that although the empirical evidence in my book is about DBAO, the book is not about DBAO per se, but really about how DBAO allows us to see the depth of the Chinese government's preoccupation, maybe obsession, with political order and what it calls wending or stability.
Yeah, yeah. What were the aha moments for you? How did you make this? When did you suddenly realize, you know what? All of this, I'm gonna, you know, shift the focus of this. That my thesis has to be about how it's used for stability maintenance.
I think it evolved when I was on the ground talking to folks and realizing that DBAO is a program about poverty alleviation, and it is a program where benefits go to those who are poorest. But it's more than that. It's also a way in which the Chinese government's kind of focus on maintaining stability is influencing really broad, diverse array of programs, including DBAO. And when I was talking to specifically to DBAO recipients and people who had been denied DBAO, I realized that there's something more than just being poor. I think there are two types of people who get DBAO. One are those who are incredibly poor and have no other means of obtaining some form of security. So they can't find other jobs. They can't rely on their family for support. So that's one class of people. The other class of people are poor, incredibly poor, but people who the regime thinks are likely to engage in destabilizing activities in the future. People who I learned later are classified as targeted populations or zhongjianrenkou. And that latter part was something that no one had really written about, and definitely not in the context of DBAO. So I felt that it was important to bring that to light. And also important that it, because it allows us to kind of understand how the Chinese government works.
Yeah, yeah. You start your book with this really interesting anecdote, but it really will kind of portrait a sketch of two families, one of which actually receives DBAO. And I think the idea is that, you know, if you were to look at their objective conditions, any reader would conclude that, you know, family A, I can't remember, is the Wongs and the Lees or something like that. Probably not real names, just common surnames. It looked like the Wongs were the ones who were the more obvious, deserving, DBAO recipients, but it was the Lees that got it. And it was because one of the young men in the Lee family was an ex-con, had been recently released from prison, and had what was, I suppose, in their calculation, a higher propensity to engage in antisocial or criminal activity, right? I mean, exactly what you said, stuff that would be destabilizing. And so I thought that was a really, really great way to open onto it, and it pulled me in right away. I thought it was, wow, that's interesting. Did you see this replicated all over the place? Was this common where you would see the people who were seemingly much more deserving, but the one difference was some identifiable thing that made them appear to have a higher propensity to engage in criminal activity?
So I would say at first it wasn't obvious. Because what I saw repeatedly was that many people who are really at the margins of society, who are barely kind of eking by in urban China, where cost of living can be quite high, were not receiving DBAO.
Right.
And many people who were seemed like the type of people that policymakers had told me were prioritized for D-ball. So many people who were getting B-ball were extremely poor, but disabled, maybe ill, elderly, with no family. So that was clear. But then there were these people who were getting D-ball that didn't fit into what I'd come to expect, that weren't disabled, ill, elderly. And so it was trying to figure out, why were these people getting D-ball when so many others were turned away, that I realized it was this characteristic of potentially destabilizing stability that was coming into play. So it took a while for me to figure that out, but it was actually the absence of these other characteristics. Right.
You had to eliminate other things like maybe they're connected somehow to the people who were, you know, in the Minzhengju, in the Civil Administration Bureau, who were handing this stuff out.
That's right.
They had guanxi, or maybe they had cheated somehow. You had to eliminate all that first. Okay. Wow, fascinating. I mean, there are other countries in the world. This is not unique to China, right? The use of social assistance to help to maintain social stability. Bread was subsidized in pre-1789 France, very, very, you know, extensively, right? You had bread in circuses in the Roman Republic, in the Empire, right? This is not unique to China, right?
That's right. There's a lot of historical precedents, a lot of research that shows throughout history, governments, especially non-democratic ones, use social welfare in order to maintain stability. I think what's different about China's case is that when D-ball was first started in the 1990s, it was, I think, genuinely part of an effort to build a cohesive social security net in China. It wasn't at that point purely about maintaining stability. But over time, the program has taken on these characteristics where the benefits are used really instrumentally to co-opt certain individuals or to demobilize certain people.
As you say, D-ball started, I think, in Shanghai in 1993 or something like
that's
that,
right,
in the early 1990s. You wrote something really interesting in your book, and just now you alluded to this, that in the early and mid-1990s, and again, around the time that D-ball was introduced, China's leadership still looked at social unrest as a consequence of economic growth, and that shifted to a position where economic prosperity was seen as prophylactic against social instability. In other words, they used to think that, you know, things would get messy as people got richer, that, you know, letting the free market work was going to produce instability. And I remember when that was sort of the thinking. I think that a lot of people saw 89 as sort of a consequence of having allowed market forces to run. But then the thinking really shifted to one where the richer people got, the more they'd buy into the system. Is that the thinking? The more invested they would be in maintaining the status quo, they would become co-opted.
So the thinking has definitely changed. I think everyone who knows China knows that the CCP cares about stability. And you often hear, well, I feel like many people know that quote from Deng Xiaoping from 1989, where he says something like, "To China's problems, overwhelming priority is stability. Without stability, you know, everything will be lost."
Right.
But I think fewer people know or remember what you said, which is that stability wasn't always the end all and be all. So even after Tiananmen, Deng's objective was economic modernization. It was about creating a socialist market economy. And the idea, exactly as you said, is that economic reform, privatization would lead to social unrest. That social unrest could then hinder economic progress, so it had to be managed somehow, and Social Security was one part of how that should be managed. But now I think as economic development is seen as a way of maintaining stability. So instead of a cause of stability, it's a way of maintaining stability. But I think the turning point for that really happened after the Falun Gong protests in 1999. So throughout the 1990s, the CCP had dealt with mass unrest, but it was always economic, mostly laid off workers, pensioners who were suffering as really a direct result of privatization. But in 1999, then you have thousands of Falun Gong practitioners surrounding Zhongnanhai, which is the largest collective action event in Beijing since Tiananmen in 1989. And they were mobilizing not because of economic grievances, but for social and political rights. And so that, I think, is a wake up or changed the CCP's thinking about both unrest as well as stability.
And the relationship between stability and economic growth, right?
That's right. That's right.
When did so you talk about three different types of targets? There are soft targets. This is in the meritocratic or quasi meritocratic system of advancement within the hierarchy of the Chinese Communist Party. Officials are ranked on their ability to hit soft targets, hard targets, and then there's what you call veto targets. Social stability has become now a veto target. It's the highest level priority in official advancement and in promotion, so that an official who fails to maintain social order in the region that he or she is responsible for is just simply not going to get promoted, irrespective of how well they did in hitting those other targets, GDP growth or job creation or environmental stewardship. When did this happen, and how significant is this to the what you talk about, to the use of Dibao as a tool in the toolbox for social stability maintenance?
Yeah, so this started happening in the aftermath of Tiananmen. Wang Yuhua and Carl Minzer have done research showing that suppressing protests, social mobilization was started being embedded in these advancement metrics in the 1990s. The thing I observed with Dibao requires that, but in addition, it requires a change in how China approached maintaining stability, which happened in the 2000s. So in September 2001, the opinions on further strengthening comprehensive management of public security came out. And that document stated that party and government organs at all levels of government can't just rely on the public security system to ensure political order, but needed to coordinate with all other bureaucracies to manage public security. And that includes civil affairs, labor, social security, education, health, family planning. And so it's a combination of both the targets, the inclusion of suppressing protest as a veto target, and the fact that maintaining security becomes not just the responsibility of public security, but of all, every single bureaucracy, that we see the transformation of Dibao into a tool of stability maintenance.
So I'm curious, Jen, did you find direct evidence then of coordination between two bureaucracies that are really relevant here, between the Civil Administration Bureau, the Minzhengju, and on the other hand, the PSB or other organs of security? Was there actual evidence that they were coordinating, or is the social stability facet of Dibao more a result of you use the word seepage, right?
That's right.
Just sort of a...
Yeah, so when you look at the Dibao policy documents, which are issued by the ministry and lower bureaus of civil affairs, you don't really see any mention of security.
Hmm.
But when you look at what the public security and ministry and security apparatus is doing, you often then see Dibao and civil affairs being brought in. So for example, during like a national conference on this like comprehensive management of public security, you see the Minister of Civil Affairs there talking about how we must ensure these surveyed populations, these populated people under surveillance, if they're poor, they need to get Dibao. Or how local departments of civil affairs are working with public security bureaus to make sure everyone undergoing re-education, if they're poor, gets Dibao. So you see a lot of this collaboration between civil affairs and public security when you start looking into public security activities, but you don't see that if you're just focused on Dibao policies.
Do you know if the Civil Affairs Bureau is using, a pre-crime computer system? Are they using, deep learning and big neural networks, using big neural networks to assess who the people are who who have a proclivity to civil unrest? I mean, how are they figuring out? Because not long ago, we did a show with Bethany Allen Ibrahimian, who's now at Axios, but she had done some work with the ICJA on a set of documents that had been leaked about Xinjiang, and you were using just such a system to, with who knows what inputs, because you never know, to figure out who was showing signs of propensity to, you know, engage in one of the three evils of terrorism or separatism or Islamic fundamentalism. Is there something like that for the poor?
Yeah. So in my book, I'm doing research in my fieldworks in the 2010, 2011, 2012. At that point, what I find is that the identification of these populations is mostly through grassroots informants. And it's difficult because it's really hard to predict who's going to do things in the future if they've never done anything in the past. So there are a lot of usage of past characteristics, like were they previously in prison, as a way of saying, okay, this is someone who should go into this program. Then as I was finishing the book, I was going through and reviewing all my links and to policy documents. And I realized that every single online mention of the targeted population program had been removed. So I was like, was I totally imagining this? I didn't archive into the Internet Archive. I just downloaded these documents. Am I going crazy? So I looked on CNKI, which is a repository of academic journals and research, and I searched for targeted 中年人口, targeted populations. And at this point, so this is now 2018, 2019, every single article is about the use of big data in managing and controlling targeted populations. So the answer is yes, they're absolutely using big data. They've tried to remove as much information about this program as possible from publicly available online sources. But all indications are that it's still going on and it's moving from grassroots informants to large-scale data and probably machine learning.
The Tom Cruise movie Minority Report, of course, takes place in a future America. But your book talks about how an authoritarian state like China and a democratic state like the U.S. would weigh things very differently when it comes to using this kind of precog, this, you know, preemptive surveillance. You introduce a kind of choice between precision and recall. Can you talk about how that works and why there is such a stark difference and maybe give some examples of why Americans so far have shown themselves to be very averse to using recall?
Yeah, so in the U.S., I was reading some recent articles about how the use of machine learning and in particular facial recognition systems have led to wrong predictions of who should be arrested. So that is an example of a machine learning system that leads to a false positive, someone who is said to be a criminal when in fact they are not at all that person. And this case in the U.S. is leading to lawsuits that are challenging the use of these systems by police in the U.S. So that's a case where people really care that you don't get anyone in the system that shouldn't belong there. But in China, that is not the case at all. From my field work, which is looking at grassroots, kind of these non-technological systems of identification, it really doesn't matter if people who are unlikely to be to do something destabilizing to the Chinese regime are identified as targets of surveillance and placed under intensive surveillance. One, it justifies budgets because public security apparatus can say, oh, we've identified these number of people, we've met our target. We need our budget for next year. And what instead is problematic in the China case, thinking, you know, if I'm a local official, is if I don't get someone who is a troublemaker. And that's why for the Chinese government, they're willing, or these local officials, they're much more willing to say, I can make all sorts of mistakes and take people into the system who are not criminals, as long as I get every single one of those who are possibly going to be engaging in destabilizing activity in the future.
As I often say, China comes up with a very different answer to the trolley problem than the U.S. tends to every time. I hate to sound so reductionist, but often it just sort of boils down to that. I totally encourage everyone to check out Jen's book. It's affordable, at least in its Kindle version. I think it's only $10, but it's like $100 if you buy it in hardback. So get the Kindle version, check it out. It's actually a really, it sounds dense and everything, but it's actually a really fun interesting read. I got through it really quickly. Let's move on to another paper that you've done, which I think was just fascinating. Something that you co-wrote with Ingdan Liu. I'm going to resist the temptation to open this segment with something like, a Stanford professor set out to study the use of clickbait headlines in Chinese propaganda. What she found will blow your mind. Seriously, you won't believe what happens next. This paper is called Capturing Clicks, How the Chinese Government Uses Clickbait to Compete for Visibility. And oh, come on, that's so clickbaity.
Well, at least I didn't say you won't believe what the Chinese government does. Right?
Yeah,
you must be tempted. I was really tempted. Really tempted. Yeah.
So, I mean, this is back to familiar ground for you in some ways. In the it's about social media, and in this case, about propaganda, which is something that you've done a lot of work on. What's interesting is that this time you went for a pretty tough target, Weixin or WeChat, which most researchers will tell you is somewhat more difficult, you know, because of the private nature of so many of the groups. But you got around that. Can you talk about what you set out to test and how you designed your research?
Yeah, the original motivation is actually exactly as you said, which is that, you know, there's so much research about Weibo, there's very little about Weixin, WeChat, even though it is such a dominant platform in China. And the way we got around the kind of private nature of WeChat is that actually focus on public accounts, and specifically public government accounts. Right. In the past few years, there's been a big push for local level governments to establish a direct to public communication channel. It's funny because there, you know, we often think of Chinese state media as completely state controlled. But increasingly among especially local governments, there's a feeling that state media is too commercialized. They're too influenced by commercial incentives. And so the government needs a way of reaching the public directly. And as a result of that, there's been a proliferation of government accounts on WeChat and also other platforms like Douyin, which is Chinese branding for TikTok. Because of that, then we thought, let's see what these local governments are doing. How similar is this to central level propaganda? Are they doing things differently? And so we did we designed two parts of the research. One is to collect titles of WeChat posts from over 200 government accounts. So that generated about 200,000 titles over a 1 to 2 year period.
These are local governments.
These are city level governments.
City level, right.
Yeah, we found that a pretty high proportion of city level governments had WeChat accounts or kind of official WeChat accounts. So that's what we decided to focus on. And we also, actually, I should say, spent some time with some offices that were in charge of running these accounts to really understand how are they making their decisions, how do they choose what content to put out, how did they choose the headlines for their content. So we kind of combined this more qualitative research approach with analysis of the kind of textual data that we gathered.
Jen, these offices that are in charge, they're always within the governments themselves, or do they ever outsource to private marketing companies?
It varies. Sometimes they're within the propaganda department. Sometimes they're within the government information office. Sometimes there are people who are seconded from media outlets.
That's interesting.
Other times they're hiring directly people who are graduating in journalism and PR.
When did you did you notice immediately looking at all of these titles, you know, these 20,000 or 200,000 odd, that there was a high prevalence of clickbaity titles? Was it like it leapt out at you instantly?
Yeah. Because originally, this wasn't supposed to be a paper about clickbait. But as we were going through the content, I was like, "What is this? these titles are just like what I see on like ads on social media in the U.S. or like,
so it's not just like in China. I mean, not just like commercial media in China. It's actually like U.S. clickbait strategy. It's the same thing.
Yeah, there are many similar strategies like listicles, you know, the five things you have to know. I think there it's pretty consistent that these are strategies that generate curiosity in some way but don't satisfy it. And as a result, it is incredibly different from what you would see in a headline of a Chinese newspaper.
I wonder if savvy media consumers in China feel the same kind of self-loathing that I feel when I'm looking at Apple News in the morning and I see that stupid BuzzFeed clickbaity, and I just, when I click through it, I always regret it and I feel this horrible. I wonder if Chinese feel the same. Anyway, it's interesting. Are there clickbait techniques that you found in there that Chinese propagandists are using that aren't being used by American marketers or media companies? I mean, could we learn something?
I don't know that American marketers would learn something new from the Chinese government use of clickbait. but I can give you some examples.
Definitely give me some examples.
Let me guess, it's like
10 songs that you joined the Chinese Communist Party in the Jiang Zemin era, or how about only people who were young pioneers in the 90s will get these 23 references.
No, they're not that good. One is at all CCP members, so at Soyou Dongyuan, you can't do these things, helping you understand newly revised party discipline regulations. So it's like somehow framing party discipline as, you know, generating fear that you're going to be doing something wrong and at signing all CCP members.
You're doing it wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Another one is like Party Secretary X spent 3 consecutive days in this county for inspection just to do these things well. These 2 things well, ...
God.
It's not that exciting, but they're definitely using these strategies. Yeah, I know. Yeah, they should.
They should hire me. Man, I could. Although I just hate clickbait titles. I just hate them. But like you said, your data set was city level officials. Do you think that it's pretty much the same at higher levels of government and party? I mean, I can't imagine it would be like that's how the central.
We haven't looked at the data from central government bureaus, but this seems to be very specific to local governments to try to build a relationship with an audience and to try to capture an audience. Because the guidance for these local level governments is that they should be doing these things in order to be able to sway public opinion, especially after sudden events.
Oh, right.
So the idea is that they need to have built up an audience over time so that if something happens and the government, the central level, wants local levels to be able to reach the public, they're able to do so.
But the central didn't tell them how to do this. I mean, there was never like a central or provincial level directive that said, okay, I want you guys to start, you know, using to study, learn from our comrades at BuzzFeed or something. No, it was that thing that always happens, which is that they're given a set of KPIs of these, you know, performance indicators, right? And they have to meet these targets and it's up to you to figure out how to do it. And of course, they always take the best practices, or in this case, the worst practices of the commercial media, right?
Yeah, that's right. And the work of these people is heavily quantified.
Oh, wow, yeah.
So frequently they're evaluated on how many posts do they make, how many likes do they get, how many views do they get. And there's this one metric that people in different places kept mentioning, which was 十万加, so 100,000 plus views. Like, you want that. You want like a certain number of posts with more than 100,000 views. So yeah, these KPIs are being set for them, and because it's online, these metrics are easily obtainable, analyzable, comparable. Different departments are ranked regularly on their performance on these metrics, so they're under a lot of pressure to get views and to get likes.
This research reminds me of a lot of other stuff that I've read, by scholars like Maria Repnikova or Danny Stockman, who work on this stuff. So if people are interested in sort of modern media strategies, check out their works. They're fantastic scholars. This feels like so quintessentially 21st century China to me. This weird amalgam of like the very popular media style, used in government propaganda. This is sort of the equivalent of those, you know, hip hop videos from Chinese officials or something. Oh, yeah. That was a really fun paper. I highly recommend it. So, once again, that paper is called Capturing Clicks: How the Chinese Government Uses Clickbait to Compete for Visibility. And we'll link to it on the show notes to this episode. I want to do another one of your papers, which is also just fascinating, about hiring, about how companies perpetuate and resist government censorship. And that's something that you co-wrote with Tung Tung Zhang, right? Is that, she's one of your
That's right. That's right. I should say, yeah, so Ying Dan, who I worked on the clickbait paper with, is a PhD candidate in communication at Stanford. And Tong Tong Zhang is a PhD candidate in political science at Stanford.
Right. You actually, by courtesy, are also a professor of political science, whatever by courtesy means. But I see that in your bio sometimes.
funny academic terms. It means I'm part of the community. Yeah.
Yeah. But you, your work is all, you know, it's the communication element of political science, which I think is properly political science. Anyway, let's talk about what you set out to test here. I mean, I think it was a really fascinating paper. You set it up. I mean, in the abstract, I think people can read, the context is we've seen a lot of companies sort of knuckle under, at least sort of at surface level, to Chinese demands for apologies. You know, people can probably recite a long list of companies that have had to do this. And we looked at the relationship between corporations in China and Chinese propaganda and censorship, especially censorship. So tell us how you set this up. This is really interesting.
Yeah, so the motivation is really to try to understand how much does your political values matter in non-political kind of everyday life. So if you express support for Western political institutions like multi-party competition or national level elections, does that really matter to employers? Is that penalized in any way? So that was really the motivation. And the way we went about testing this is to do a resume audit experiment. So there are really famous types of experiments that have been done in the US and other countries to look at workplace discrimination. For example, do employers discriminate between men and women who have the same, you know, other characteristics, same resume, other characteristics, do they discriminate based on race? And so here we
right, like they'll submit the same exact resume, but one will be, you know, like Chad Worthington,
exactly.
And the other will be like Kwame.
That's right, exactly. Like that, right? And so we use that same setup, but the thing we vary is their extracurricular activity. So we have three treatment conditions. One is the control, which is that they do participate in a comic club, a comic book reading group. The second one is that they participate in a socialism with Chinese characteristics study group. So this one is demonstrating political loyalty. So you just know that college students in China have to take a number of required courses on Xi Jinping thought, Marxist thought. So then doing an extracurricular where you're reading more works about socialism, Chinese characteristics, is a signal that you're really loyal.
A real ass kisser.
You're loyal.
Real brown.
And then the third treatment condition, the extracurricular activity, is a Western political philosophy reading group where, you know, in the sub bullet points, we say that you're reading works on democratic institutions and the like. And so then we submit these three resumes to thousands of job openings throughout China in all different types of regions, all different types of industries, different types of job positions, to see who gets more callbacks.
What did you expect was going to happen? What was your expectation?
I would say my personal expectation was that it shouldn't matter.
Really? So okay, so I was going to guess.
Yeah, I would have guessed
that it would matter.
I was maybe too optimistic. I was hoping that it wouldn't matter. Even though I think looking at the literature, our expectation was that loyalists should be rewarded and those who are deviating from the political norm should be penalized.
Right. That's what we would have thought. Right.
That's, I think, what the literature expects us to find. What we found instead is that political loyalty is not at all rewarded. There is no benefit in saying, in expressing your adherence to socialism with Chinese characteristics, but that participating in the Western political philosophy group did result in fewer callbacks.
Okay. And there's a lot of granular stuff that I want to get into because it's just so interesting. But one of the top level findings was that it didn't even matter whether we're talking about state-owned enterprises, whether we're talking about private companies or even multinational companies, right? That the rates of callback were comparable. There wasn't a statistically significant difference with these three different groups.
That's right. Doesn't matter the ownership structure of the company, we find this kind of punishing of political dissent across the board.
So there's another part to the experiment. So not only did you just fire off all of these otherwise identical resumes, but you also talked to a bunch of hiring managers, right?
Yeah, we kind of did a survey with a couple hundred hiring managers, again, in all different types of firms, all different places in China. We wanted them to actually look at the resume and tell us what they were seeing, why they didn't like the candidate that was expressing, that was participating in the Western Political Philosophy Group, why they didn't prefer the candidate that was participating in the Socialism, the Chinese Characteristics Study Group.
I thought what was just the most interesting thing was the reason why a lot of these interview subjects said that this marker of political dissent, you know, that you were a leader in this Western political philosophy study group, was so seen so widely by so many of the interview subjects as like marking independent thinking or creativity or critical thinking. That was, I guess, not totally surprising, but kind of pleasing to learn that was associated.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the reason why the hiring managers didn't sometimes penalize participation in Western Political Philosophy Group was the fear that this person wouldn't be politically reliable,
right,
wouldn't
right.
adhere too closely to what the company wanted, especially in working with the government. But there were actually certain subset of companies that did prefer the Western Political Philosophy group. It was just a smaller proportion.
What were those?
The larger proportion. So I should say, the largest proportion of firms actually did not care. Didn't care whether you were a comic book club member, Western Political Philosophy, or Socialism with Chinese Characteristics.
See, I would penalize the comic book people. I would just penalize the
They're not serious. but so most employers are not paying attention to that. They're paying attention to your academic credentials and merit.
But there is
two other groups, one that prefers Western political philosophy, one that really that penalizes Western political philosophy. And
let's talk about that first group first, because I'm curious. I can't remember which group was
right.
That.
So you're right that the firms that prefer individuals who do Western political philosophy do that because they think these people are more innovative, more creative, more likely to think outside of the box. So there is a group of firms that like these type of people, but it just happens.
What industry? What industry?
So there's no difference by industry. The only difference that we observe in preference for this type of people are hiring managers who have direct reports. So people who are managers who've had teams working for them have this preference for individuals who are more creative and more innovative and more likely to think outside the box. So so there is this group of firms that likes these types of people. But it just happens that there's a larger group of firms that don't like individuals who participate in Western political philosophy. And that's why on average, there is this penalty for expressing this type of belief on a resume.
I have to say, I was really surprised at what industry it was that prefers the socialism with Chinese characteristics folks over the Western philosophy folks. That was really surprising to me because I think we're so conditioned, especially where you live in Silicon Valley, to think that technology industries, technology companies want those rule breakers, those individualists, want those creative types. But
yeah, so in China, the one industry that really doesn't like Western political philosophy and would prefer the loyalists and the comic book people over them are technology firms in China.
Wow.
And in the kind of interviews and open-ended responses, questions that we asked of hiring managers, they say it's because they've gotten specific, very specific guidance from the government that they need to be extra cautious about who they hire.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I can see that. So these presumably would be where content moderation is even an issue at all, right? So this would be in technology companies that touch social media. It wouldn't be like in a chip manufacturer. It wouldn't be a technology company that just makes like drones or something like that, right?
Yeah, I think in the classification, this is information technology, not
information
hardware, software.
Okay. So that's fascinating. I mean, and I guess I would have been probably, you know, thrilled to discover this, and I would have been, you know, dancing it. But it's interesting that that's what you expected to find. Maybe I think that you've been doing this for longer. You've been looking at this data, and you're continually, I think, surprised. No, you're continually surprised that conventional wisdom still endures despite all the work that you've been doing. Because just about every study that I've read from you upends something that I had believed. But you know, here's one issue with this particular study, which is that. Do you think that the thinking that informs hiring decisions is the same as the thinking that informs the decision, say, whether to fire somebody who retweets a pro-Hong Kong or pro-Tibetan independence post on a corporate Twitter account, whether it's the same as the decision to, you know, demand an apology or to knuckle under if you're, you know, the NBA or Blizzard or one of the many other companies it's had to, because some guy, put Taiwan on a list of countries or, you know, called Tsai Ing-wen the president or something like that. You know, these things that we've seen happen again and again and again. Is there a connection? Do you draw a strong connection between hiring preferences and how they would behave in those circumstances?
I think it's distinct. So in those circumstances, the whole company from top to bottom are focused on making a decision after a high profile political action that the company has taken. The hiring decisions that I'm talking about are much more everyday business decisions that a company makes, that hundreds of people in any particular company are making every minute of the day. And these hiring decisions reflect not the attention of the whole company in taking a particular position, but in the how both the broader political environment as well as the company's particular culture influences individuals who are making these decisions that then I think aggregate up to the bulk of decisions that a company makes over time.
Right. So where does that change happen? I guess it's just sort of, it doesn't, it's not a proportional scaling of that attitude. It changes somewhere along the way when it reaches a certain level of the impact on the entirety of the company, right?
That's right. That's
okay.
Right.
Okay. Hmm. Yeah. Fascinating. Jen, what are you working on now? what you can say without giving away the store? I'm kind of waiting with bated breath for your next. Oh, by the way, we are going to have, just for the listeners, we're going to have Jen back to talk about another paper that she's co-authored that I thought was just fascinating. This, we don't have time for it today, but we'll do a whole episode based on that, which looks at anti-Chinese racism, you know, xenophobia in the United States, and regime support among people who are victims of that. So we'll talk about that paper again and what it says about the formation of nationalist identity. So, but what else can we expect from you down the road soon?
So I'm working on kind of two areas of research. One is related to public opinion. So how do people in China form their preferences? How does that intersect with their identity? How is this influenced by different forms of state propaganda? So thinking about how the government is shaping the public and how the public is responding. So that's one. So different papers in that area. The other kind of areas more along the lines of digital media and how changes in digital technologies are changing the way in which the Chinese government is or is not able to exert control over the public.
These are all things that I'm just fascinated by, so I'm going to be totally on top of that. We'll definitely have you back.
Thank you.
It's just great stuff. I'm always interested in the research areas that you're in, and always just kind of blown away by the very clever research design that you bring to bear. It makes social science seem extremely fun, even when you're, you know, processing gigantic data sets of, you know, hundreds of thousands of this or that. But fantastic stuff. Jen, let's move on now to recommendations. Let me quickly remind listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SupChina. And if you like what we're doing with Seneca and with the other shows in the Seneca network, the very best way that you can support our work is to subscribe to SupChina's daily newsletter, Access. This thing is just chock full of great reads on China delivered to your inbox every weekday. So sign up and spread the word. Okay, for recommendations, Jen, what do you have for us?
All right, so I noticed that most people give recommendations really close to what their research is on, but I'm gonna go away from the topic.
Good.
So outside of everything, all the books and papers I'm reading in my discipline, I am all about escapist fiction these days. And so my recommendation is The Murderbot Diaries by Martha Wells. Have you read it?
No. The Murderbot Diaries. That sounds great.
So it's a series of sci-fi novellas and then one full-length book. It follows a cyborg who is a self-styled murder bot. It's super fun, escapist. The voice of the murder bot is super funny, and it's set in this future where corporations control the galaxy. And if you get to the final book, I think it raises a really interesting point about the interchangeability of computer code and human code. So if you want to get away from it all, you should read some murder bot.
Oh. And who doesn't? Okay, I'm on it. Murderbot Diaries. Fantastic. I'm going to recommend something also away from our topic. It's the book Evil Geniuses, The Unmaking of America by Kurt Anderson. Kurt Anderson is an author I just really, really like. I like everything he writes in The New Yorker and Vanity Fair and other really good outlets. But his last book, Fantasyland, was one that it's one of those rare books that both Jeremy and I both just loved immoderately. We both really, really liked it. Now, that was about the whole history of, you know, across five centuries of American cranks, quacks, conspiracy theorists, nutbags of all sorts. And so obviously that's really fun to read about. But this one looks at the recent history of the U.S. and takes a deep, deep dive into the reasons why we moved from being a country, you know, still as late as the late 1970s with a very steeply progressive tax code, a very low Gini coefficient. We went away from that, you know, we were on the path toward becoming, you know, like Scandinavian countries or like Canada, to this wildly unequal country, you know, that we live in today. It's about, you know, Reagan, of course, and the financialization of the American economy, and about the complicity of people like Bill Clinton and the DLC. But he's really engaging and often very, very humorous. I mean, you know, he cut his teeth writing for Harvard Lampoon back when he was an undergraduate. But Kurt Anderson's book, it's fantastic. Check it out, Evil Geniuses. Jen, what a pleasure finally to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It was fun.
Yeah, we're going to do it again, though, so I'll see you soon. And really looking forward to it. It'll be fun. The Seneca podcast is powered by SupChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@supchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SupChina News. And make sure to check out all the other podcasts in the Seneca Network. Watch this space for announcements of new network shows. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.